Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, founding CEO of Literal Humans and your host. And I'm joined today by some amazing gentlemen who are doing some incredible work in health tech. I'm joined today by Dr. Benjamin Deldar and David Hanbury, the co-founders of Deep Medical. And we're here to talk about using AI to solve patient no-shows. Welcome to the pod, y'all.
Hey.
It's great to be here.
So by way of a very long but very deserved introduction, we're here today to talk about how health systems worldwide struggle with a quiet but massive issue, patient no-shows. And Lord knows I've been one of them before. In the NHS, missed appointments cost billions each year and leave clinicians stretched while patients lose access to care. Deep Medical is founded to tackle this problem at scale. Their AI platform analyzes data to predict which patients are most at risk missing appointments and why. The insight allows hospitals to act early, whether that's with reminders, support, outreach, or that patients get the care that they need. Benjamin brings his experience as a medical doctor and clinical entrepreneur, while David adds deep expertise in AI, data science, and finance. Sounds like a perfect professional marriage. I want to dig into that a little bit later. Together, they're building technology that could reduce inequalities in healthcare and make systems way more efficient for patients and their providers. Welcome to the pod, y'all.
Hi, Paul. Great to be here.
Cool. Well, thanks for tolerating that very long introduction, but you guys have done some great work and we want to give you credit for that. Let's jump into like frame the problem for our audience here. So, you know, why are patient no-shows? Like, I think everyone knows intuitively why they're a problem, but why are they such a critical issue in healthcare today?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should start with some of the macro things that take place in healthcare. So it takes somewhere between 12 to 20 years to become a specialist doctor. And so it's a long training process. And it takes a long time to become skilled enough to see patients in a specialist environment. And we have an aging population and growing health needs and demands. So from a supply and demand issue, everyone is asking the question, which is how can we get more out of our existing workforce, or how do we actually train more people in that pipeline? So every minute, every second of a doctor's time is valuable because it could be face time that we could be using to see patients and to solve problems. And so this is a really great operational problem because not only is there a cost element to it, so on average in the UK, 8% of patients miss their appointments. And another 4% of our appointments just go to waste because we struggle to fill them after someone cancels. That's 12 million appointments a year, £2 billion worth of waste. Actually, when you look at that globally, in the US, 24% of their patients miss their appointments, which wastes $150 billion. And, you know, this problem is facing every single health industry. And really what the opportunity here is that there's not just the cost element, but then when you look into the life element, you know, if you can't get to see your doctor's at the time that you need to, you have worse health outcomes. And there's lots of research that show at least correlation between attendance and no-shows and worse health outcomes. So a really large study in Scotland found that patients that miss just two appointments a year to their primary care physicians, or general practitioners as they're called here, had a 3 times increase in all-cause mortality. So wow. They were 3 times more likely to die within that year than the same patient, the same condition. So it's a great opportunity to say, how do we narrow the gap, address equity and access or personalized access to care? And then at the same time, how do we make healthcare more sustainable?
Yeah.
And really, this is a perfect application of the two.
Yeah, I'd love to dig into that a little bit more because like you've shared some really stark like costs and sort of, you know, stats on what it's, what the system is essentially being taxed by these no-shows. But the piece around inequalities, like that's something I want to dig into a bit more. So like beyond the, you know, broad costs, like how exactly do missed appointments deepen inequalities in healthcare access? Because I feel like our audience is maybe trying to, you know, connect the dots there and understand how those are connected.
Yeah, completely. I mean, if you look at from an equity and access perspective, or just an equity perspective, in this country, despite having a national health service, which is free at the point of care, we have one of the worst health outcomes. What does that mean? There's a 10-year life expectancy difference between the richest and poorest 20%. And in the US, that's about 15 years. And when we look at the data, we see that it's those same population groups that might be struggling from deprivation and social determinants of healthcare that are the ones that are likely to miss their appointments more than everybody else. And so what does that mean in practice? Well, when we've spoken to patients and asked them, you know, what's going on, often we find it's not about forgetting and reminding. It's things like, I can't afford to take the time off work. Do I choose to go to work for that day or do I go to the hospital? And on the other side, you know, things like, do I take my child to school? Do I have to look after somebody else in the home environment? Do I understand exactly what's been sent to me in terms of messaging and actually comprehension? So these are more deeper inequalities that are taking place when we get to the roots of it. And they're resulting in worse health outcomes, which means that there is a deeper inequity at play in terms of how we coordinate care for people.
And you mentioned, I'm glad you mentioned like the, you know, reminders, and like there's been an effort to obviously digitize and to, you know, have scheduling tools and things like that. I want to unpack like why this problem has been so persistent and move into, you know, discussing how Deep Medical's AI helps hospitals get ahead of this problem and address these no-shows and maybe even prevent them.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think actually we've done a really good job and it's kind of left us with an unsolvable problem until very recently. So, you know, if I was to run a clinic from scratch and start reminding patients with a text message reminder system, I'll reduce my no-show rates by 30%. If I give the patients a chance to cancel and reschedule via text, I tend to reduce it by an extra 10%. What we're showing is that we can optimize communication using AI, using tech that's really similar to what you have on social media, which sends you a targeted advert into healthcare, and reduce the no-show rates by an extra 23% on top of those two-way text messaging. But when you end up with a small level of a problem, it feels like, you know, it's something that you accept. And that's what we find in many healthcare systems, where a no-show rate of 8%, you know, is never 8% every day. One week it's 20%, the next week it's 0%, the next week it's 15%. So standard practices like sending more messages or overbooking clinics, they don't work anymore. And that's really where we get into it and start to increase the capacity and the ability for patients to be seen.
And there's like a predictive element to what you're doing. So I'd love you to walk us through like how exactly your system actually predicts who might miss an appointment and why, and how to address that. That's the most fascinating part for me.
Absolutely. So in order to make our predictions, what we do is we take about 10 to 15 years of historical attendance data from the hospital clients that we go into. And the really important thing to note about this data is that from the moment we started building these algorithms in 2018, we made it a crucial point that there would be no sensitive data or sensitive data fields, or indeed any personally identifiable data in the data that we use to train the models. So that was a really important part of what we did. But this sort of data that we gather from the hospitals, it's obviously got the prevalence of no-shows for those patients in the past, a load of other factors that we get from that data. And we then combine it with other external data sources. So things such as weather forecasts, traffic forecasts, event data related roughly to where the home location of the patient is, how hard it is to travel from the home to the hospital. And what you do is you end up with about 200 factors that go into the predictions that we make in order to decide whether a patient is likely to no-show or not. And this is the perfect thing for AI, really, because you can imagine, you know, it's not just the fact that Mrs. Higgins has a 9:30 a.m. appointment to get to, it's the fact that Mrs. Higgins has a 9:30 appointment and a bad hip, and it's predicted to be cold on that day, and she has poor transport links into the hospital. And all of these combine in a very complicated, nonlinear manner that make it perfect for AI. You can understand it'd be a very difficult computation for a human that, but it's, as I said, it's perfect for AI.
That's amazing. And I'd be curious, like 200 factors, I mean, that alone is fascinating, but like what have been some of the most surprising factors or data points that you've gotten out of this incredible 10 to 15 years of historical data that you've, you know, leveraged AI to pour through and to build your model around?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, lots of interesting things have come out of it. To me, the most sort of prevalent and meaningful one is that we found that if you live in more deprived neighborhoods, or the 20% most deprived neighborhoods in the UK versus the 20% least deprived, you're twice as likely to no-show. And so this is a clear indication of where health inequality comes from. You know, so you've got the fact that, you know, you're twice as likely to no-show. And then going back to the statistic that Ben mentioned, where if you no-show and you have a long-term condition and a mental health condition, you're three times more likely to die in that year. So really, there's a clear link between health inequalities and increased mortalities.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I started my career as a teacher in middle schools in the States, and worked in deprived neighborhoods, low income neighborhoods in Southwest Philly. And I remember I had a young girl who had diabetes, and she didn't have a place to, a cold storage place for her insulin. So I ended up just storing her insulin in my refrigerator in my classroom. And it's just like, you realize as a teacher that all the health inequalities kind of flow downhill into your classroom, and you see them playing out. Kids with dental issues, not able to, come in because they have a toothache and they're losing days of instruction, or not able to store their insulin and things like that. So I think I can really identify with what you're doing, because I've seen it, firsthand, and the impact that it has on other systems like education and labor and things like that. So yeah, I really appreciate what y'all are doing.
No, thank you. And you actually see that play out as people get older, right? So, that sort of statistic I find, which is the most harrowing as someone that went into medicine, which is that 10 years of life expectancy difference between the richest and poorest, 20%. In the US, as I said earlier, it's 15 years. So those consequences of how we've structured our societies, they really play out in life and quality, both on quantity of how we live our lives.
Yeah. Talk to me about your model, because there's a big piece about trust, right? And in health tech, you have to build that trust. I think health tech and actually fintech as well, I'm fascinated by this concept of trust and reliability and accuracy. So how do you ensure that your model is explainable and therefore trusted by clinicians and is not just a kind of black box, as we talk about in the algorithmic world?
That's a really good question. So we actually, a core part of what we do is provide the explainable AI behind our reasons. So for every predicted DNA, we actually provide the primary reasons why the model thinks that patient is going to no-show. And that's actually really useful, because actually if the hospital wants to do a manual intervention, they're armed with those reasons why someone might no-show. So if, for example, the model thinks it's because of really poor transport links, that gives us an option to potentially intervene there and potentially provide free transport. So that ties into the fact that we have this partnership with Uber Health, and we're about to be sending the first Uber ride in the NHS, which is very exciting. So, this is where that this sort of explainability comes in and is very useful.
That's amazing. I'm assuming you're going to make a bunch of hay about that. It's going to be a big PR event, the first ever Uber ride. Do you have the person picked out already? Do you know where it's going to be? Or?
It's going to be somewhere in Essex. So we know that. It's more than PR. The NHS is currently spending $460 million on ambulances to take patients to and from the hospital. And it's one of the number one causes of complaints when patients don't get picked up when they're expected to. And so here's a great opportunity to divert patients to a cheaper, more sustainable route of transport versus ambulances. But also, whilst we're doing that, if we're able to reduce cost, can we also level up more people in society at the same time? And that's really what I think makes our approach at Deep Medical, what we really strove for at the beginning of when we were setting this business up, which is it's not just about capacity and getting more people in, but it's also about how can we use these same models to help us not just identify those gaps, but reduce them at the same time.
That's amazing. And apologies, I got very excited. My marketing brain got very excited about the PR opportunities.
PR thing as well, for sure. But But I mean, we try to think about it as well from what are the real issues that people are facing? And I can't afford to take the journey, and transport poverty is a real thing. And the more we can do to use tech to address that, I think that's really what we can shift the needle for people.
Yeah, absolutely. We've done a couple episodes on digital poverty, and kind of a great segue into the next question about the kinds of interventions that hospitals have been able to take based on the insights from your product, targeted reminders, transport support. Are there any other interventions worth mentioning that you're looking forward to in the future roadmap or that are?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the other important thing is when you've done everything you can to try and bring a patient into the hospital and there's still excess capacity after that, it's what can you do with that? Ben mentioned earlier that we have 6 million people here on an NHS waitlist, and yet there's 12 million empty slots every year due to no-shows and unfilled cancellations. So you can really see how we can better utilize those slots and actually get through the waitlist in a short time if we were to do this. So really then it's about how do you work out how many extra people you can safely put into a clinic when you're very confident there's going to be no-shows and late-fill cancellations in those days. So really it's about doing effectively what the airlines do, but in a much cleverer way and a way that does not disrupt clinicians. And so that's really the sort of key, very important next step of what happens with our technology.
And we've shown that now. So we've been able to uncover a 2% more capacity by reducing the no-shows, and then a further 2.5% more capacity by booking an extra patient in when the AI model is saying, we still think there's going to be a gap today. What does that actually translate to? So nationally, if we were to take that for the rest of the country, it'd be 4.5 million appointments extra in a year. And really, that's not asking anyone to work harder. You know, if I was to deliver 4.5 more extra appointments, remember the first part, how many doctors would that be equating to? How many years of training would we need to put people through before we'd be able to unlock that? And actually, it's this type of evidence that we've been able to show in traction that really puts us at a really exciting position to say, you know, goodbye to the wait list and, you know, hopefully hello to how we really want care to be delivered to us.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Want to get into, you know, bringing AI into healthcare operations. Obviously, like, you know, we see all the talk out there, and healthcare in particular is a cautious, you know, sector when it comes to new tech, maybe to their own detriment in some cases. I say that coming from the education sector, which is very cautious in some ways. How do you navigate that regulation and the trust building and weave your way through these big challenges and opportunities that come with bringing AI into healthcare operations?
Yeah, I mean, I think healthcare operations are really like prime now for like disruption by technology. And that's because up till now, it's been a situation where a lot of information is kept in people's heads. And that's because it's quite difficult to book an appointment to go to see a doctor. It's very difficult for a patient, but it's also difficult for the booking team because they need to know what's wrong with you. They need to know what type of clinic you can go to. They then need to find out what your availability, what the doctor's availability is like, and then be able to schedule you in the right time. So there's many complex steps that make standard automation really difficult to do. But this is perfect for AI because understanding complexities and then being able to make that into a logical process is exactly what AI does really well at. And so I think we stand at a real sort of precipice of opportunity. And, you know, there's so much sludge in healthcare when it comes to operations and bureaucracy. In the US, there are 10 administrators for every one doctor. So imagine how we could improve the operations and also reduce cost for people at the same time. And that's why I think there's a great opportunity right now. But from a regulations and a trust building perspective, you really got to demonstrate that. And we've been really careful to ask, what's the minimum data that we need? You know, we made an early decision that we didn't want to touch health information. We don't want to know what's wrong with the patient from a clinical perspective. And actually, we found out pretty early on as well that we didn't even need to know their name. We just need to know their rough demographic features. So here's a really low risk data set. But then it's not just about the data that you collect, but the way that you apply it. And that's what builds trust. So it's listening to people. It's hearing what their issues are. We spoke to over 15,000 patients that our AI model said, we think you're going to miss your appointment. And then we built tools that was going to address the things that they said. And lo and behold, the no-show rate dropped. And so it's about having that sort of approach, which is systematic, which is to ask, what's the right data that I need? What's the implications to it? What do the people say when you actually speak to them? Not just what the data says. And then how can I layer tech and build solutions on top of that that helps us build trust and improve access?
That's great. Yeah, I mean, that 4.5 million extra appointments per year is an astounding stat. So I mean, that's incredible. Hats off for that. Wanted to use the D word, disruption. So I want to like dig into that a little bit. You know, that's a big word in tech. And I think, you know, when you're dealing with like legacy sectors like healthcare or like education, I think the people in it sometimes are like, oh, disruption, like, what does that mean? My job? Like, what, you know, so how do you navigate that? Like the NHS is such a revered institution. And so how do you sort of gently weave your way in and become a true partner? But also say like, hey, we're here to shift things. We're here to transform things in a helpful way. Like, how have y'all navigated that?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a great opportunity right now. Over COVID, you know, when I was working as a doctor in intensive care at that time, I saw millions of appointments get canceled. And so that's what's led to this wait list. And people are frustrated both with inside of the system and outside of the system to change things. It shouldn't be so difficult to book a hospital appointment. I can book a flight to anywhere in the world and I don't need to speak to anybody. So the majority of us are able to actually do the technology aspects of it. So actually, there's a great opportunity for us to think, how do we help robots be robots and people be people? And that's exactly what, you know, that disruption element has allowed us to do, because there's also the right time for that right now. People are looking for new ways People are frustrated inside of the system by the way we've currently done it and are looking for solutions about how to solve that.
Yeah, I love that strapline. How do we help robots be robots and people be people? I might use that one in the future. So thank you for that. Speaking of, you know, what you're achieving, metrics, you kind of alluded to this. Obviously, there's the 4.5 million, sort of appointments that you're able to unlock. You mentioned the 2% additional capacity plus the other 2%. What are some of the other metrics that hospital leaders and you know, clinicians are most excited about when they see your solution in action?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I really think it is those metrics speak volumes in themselves. You know, I mean, really, you know, the most important ones universally are reductions in no-show rates. You know, we've spoken about the direct links between missing appointments and worse mortality and worse health outcomes. And so across the board, whether you're in the UK or US, hospital systems are very keen to reduce no-shows. And if you look at sort of Medicaid in the US, you have 30 to 40% no-show rates often in some of these safety net hospitals. And so, you know, one of the key things they want to do is obviously reduce that no-show rate, which obviously has a knock-on operation impact in terms of the finances, et cetera, of that hospital. But yes, reducing no-shows is a key one. But then also maximizing utilization. You know, here in the UK, as I mentioned, we've got 6 million people on a wait list. Reducing wait list numbers is one of the key metrics that hospitals are doing here in the UK. And so by maximizing utilization, that's the best way to use existing capacity that you've paid for in order to get through the wait list. And then from the third perspective, you know, cutting costs. There's so many that are very repetitive that we can reduce the cost from in these systems as well. And so really it's about automating those costs away and those other two factors.
Yeah, I mean, look, reduction in no-show rates, mortality rates coming down, health outcomes improving, utilization rates, reduction in wait lists and costs. Like, that's a pretty strong list of metrics. So yeah, well done, guys. We'd be remiss if we didn't, you know, we're a growth strategy agency. We work with some of the top, you know, tech for good brands to help them scale. We'd be remiss if we didn't ask a question about your growth strategy. So how do you see Deep Medical scaling? Talk to me about fundraising, about rounds, about, you know, your growth strategy, your sales strategy, your marketing team. What does that look like? Is it UK first? And do you have global ambitions? Talk us through your next like 1 to 2 years of growth strategy if you can.
Yeah. So there are sort of two key things that we want to bring people's minds. The first is there's 6 million people waiting for a hospital appointment, and there's 12 million appointments which go missed or cancelled each year. So one of our key goals is about being able to get rid of that wait list and demonstrate that across multiple sites in the NHS. But we know that this is not just an NHS problem. You know, for every dollar spent in healthcare globally, 50 cents of it is spent in America, which is a harrowing stat. Like, that's $4.4 trillion a year. And it's growing 10% each year. And there's a no-show rate of 24% in the US healthcare system. And unfortunately, in the systems that are there to deliver care for everyone, like your Medicaid population groups, like your Medicare population groups, or your under and uninsured hospitals, I'm talking about your federally qualified healthcare centers, your safety net hospitals, your public health hospitals, those places experience no-show rates as high as 40%. Imagine 40% of your patients not turning up.
Yeah.
So really what our focus is at doing is helping address those issues. We know the same problems that face here in the UK on access and equity are the same problems that are facing in the US on a larger scale. And we know that for every missed appointment that we can reduce, that's better financial sustainability, be that in a US care system or a UK care system. Both have the same needs. And so really that's what we're focused at for sort of the next 1 to 2 years. And we're raising capital. So we're doing a Series A at the moment to start to grow and expand. We've got a pipeline of clients in the UK and soon to be US as well that are ready to, you know, trial us and move us to full implementation. And essentially what we have here is we've created time where it didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. And that's really exciting when we look beyond sort of 2 years, because time's the most valuable thing in healthcare. And if we can find time in the doctor's diaries, then what could we do with that can really disrupt how care is delivered? What do I mean? Like, why is it that my smartwatch is not connected to my primary care physician? Mm-hmm. How do we do that? And if we can find the slots or the time or the capacity that we can find which are free, we can start to think about how do we want to deliver care to people for the future, in the home, in the community, with devices, with AI, with ways that we can drive more personalized care beyond just the access and around the appointment as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating one on like connecting wearables to the health system. I think I mentioned in our pre-show that we've done some work with Oura Ring, and like that was something that always came up for me. It was like, there's so much incredible data about how well or not well I'm sleeping, and you know, my what is it, VO2 max rate, and you know, HRV and all that stuff. Like, why doesn't my doctor know that stuff? You know, like, and that I think is such an interesting, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reality is we don't have the time, right? Like, I've got a bunch of patients as inpatients. I've got to go to my outpatient setting. Then I might need to go to surgery. You know, I'm balancing 50 things at the same time. And so, you know, I think what makes us slightly the best position to really maximize that is that we've got the new version of finding time in the doctor's diaries, where before they didn't know that existed for them.
Yeah.
And so that's really where we can start to change things.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate what you said too, like that every dollar spent globally, 50 cents spent in the US. Like I've seen that experience being from the States initially and having to deal with health insurance and all that madness. But also I've a parent who's in the veterans, you know, health system, which is our version of socialized medicine. You know, basically it's your NHS for people who've been in the military before, and to see that system and how it runs and operates and things like that. And you know, in some cases, the efficiencies, in some cases, the inefficiencies. It's been fascinating. And when you put it all together, the Medicaid and the VA and, you know, the private system, you kind of see this incredible amount of, as you said, what, 10 administrators for every single doctor or something like that. It's just, it's a lot of bloat, you know. So, yeah, kudos to you for stepping into that market and trying to begin to address the larger issues there. Want to get into a little bit more personal, you know, questions about you guys. Like, what personal experiences drove you both to start Deep Medical? I mean, you're two co-founders from very different backgrounds. Talk to us about how you, we love a good co-founder story. How do you complement each other's perspectives? And you know, tell us about how you're building a mission-driven company together.
Sure. So, you know, I guess from my perspective, it started with research that I was involved in at UCL, so University College London. We were involved in trying to predict no-shows to radiology appointments, in fact, and this was back in 2018. And I think what really interested me about this problem was that there were lots of people at the time using AI to, in the slightly sexier side of AI in healthcare, to try and predict cancers and CT scans using computer vision. But very few people were actually looking at trying to solve hospital operational issues using AI. And yet the impact you can have and the lives you can save is just as big. So that's what really excited me about this. I was initially working just with computer scientists trying to solve this problem, and had no idea really of how good or bad the operations in hospitals are, the legacy systems they use. So I was struggling to try and break into sort of the NHS. And I actually met Ben at the COGX AI conference. We were matched by an algorithm. And Ben at the time was on something called the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Program. So yeah, I'll let Ben describe a bit about that.
Yeah. So I obviously was a medical doctor, so trained in the UK, did a master's in imaging sciences and engineering. And as Dave says, sexy AI. I took sexy AI and started doing and building that. And I was working for a couple of years, or just under, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and sort of trying to use AI to understand what's going on in the brain and spine and imaging. You know, what I started to become aware of, which is that this is such an important tool to deliver hyper-personalization, which I think is probably the biggest challenge that we need to deliver in healthcare. It's not just about pushing the newest drug development. It's also, how do we actually give what's available to people in the way that they need it? I realized that there was so much fear with AI in the clinical space and caution with it. I found it very difficult about how we're going to build successful companies that are going to address these problems. You know, some of them are really valid. Some of them are because we're scared of the way it's going to change our work. Some of them is because we don't have true clinical trial component of AI itself. But I realized I wasn't smart enough to solve that problem. And actually, in the operations of how we deliver care, we can still scale really successful businesses and start to think about how we address those problems around personalized care. And that's where I met Dave, and we got talking. I love the idea. I was working in intensive care during COVID at that time and seeing all of these cancellations as well that were taking place. And I said, why don't you just move in? And, you know, I've got a spare room. I was living in a flat in Wimbledon at the time. And so Dave moved in and we set up the company. And, you know, it was really like a Silicon Valley startup because, you know, we just used to think about what are the problems that we're trying to address? How do we build this? How do we build the product around it? And then get to work around that as well.
Yeah, I really think if we hadn't done that over the COVID period, particularly, you know, it may not have ever got off the ground. So it was, it was a great move there.
Yeah, there's something about like starting new businesses. I mean, we started our organization. I ended up buying my co-founder out. But there's something about that period where you just had nothing better to do than, you know, start a business and dream and work together. And yeah, I get the benefit of hearing these amazing stories all the time. So thank you for sharing your story. And, you know, millions of people are benefiting from that hard work that y'all put in. So, so yeah, thank you for that. And I love this match by an algorithm too. All the best relationships these days. It's all match by an algorithm. It's kind of scary.
I don't know. I've not had much better experiences than Dave, okay. Which is quite sad, actually. But maybe not all algorithms are good at matching.
Huh? Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll dig into that. We've had a couple dating episodes and stuff like that, so we'll try to dig into that.
Yeah, I think we need longer than an hour if we really want to dig into that.
Yeah. I mean, someone's got to be making the app for like dating no-shows, right? Is that the next one, the dating no-shows app?
Maybe.
Cool, guys. Well, let's jump into the quickfire round. So this is a round where we ask you slightly more personal, you know, personality questions, I would say, to kind of get to know you a bit better. So first thing that comes to mind, and just a quick sentence on why that's your answer. You had a chance to look at these already, so hopefully you've thought about it a little bit. After Deep Medical, amazing success. You guys are super well funded. You've transformed the NHS and the US healthcare system. If you could found another tech startup, what would it be and why?
God, well, should I go first?
Yeah, go for it.
I think you mentioned earlier, like all of the incredible data that you're collecting from your Oura Ring, from all these devices. And, you know, the way I see it going, and I'm sure it will happen very shortly, is we will have effectively our own Dr. House in our pockets. So, you know, we've got this amazing combination of AI, obviously at extraordinary levels, but also we have, you know, the ability with that AI to read every single research paper that's ever been written in any language in healthcare. Combine that with perfect visibility of your healthcare records. And then thirdly, all of the data that we're collecting from day to day through where, and you basically will have an AI doctor that could diagnose the edge cases of any disease and knows you better than anyone. So I really think this is, you know, a very exciting company. Cool. That I'm sure is in the pipelines.
Cool.
Already.
So AI concierge in your pocket. Ben, over to you. Quickfire. Remember.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I kind of hate it because Dave's just picked mine. So it looks like we're going to set up another company together.
Yeah. Okay.
I think AI doctor, really, I think is the time for it, really. We're currently in this country, in the UK, we have 15,000 people over the age of 100. And there's a really great study that was published about 2 years ago in the New England Journal, which said which asked the question, how many patients would we have, or people would we have, over the age of 100 in by 20? And the answer was 1.5 million. Yeah. So, you know, there's a huge need for healthcare going forward. And I think there's a great opportunity for AI to finally be able to step in to deliver some of that.
Absolutely. Those are great answers. Looking forward to your next company, y'all. What tech invention makes you the most excited right now? Start with you, Ben.
Yeah, I'll pick two. One is a company called XR Labs. And okay. I definitely look into it. It's basically X-ray vision meets augmented reality fused with the patient at the same time.
Okay.
They've been really doing some inspirational work separating Siamese twins because they've been able to plan for surgery during that operation. So you put these glasses on, like MetaVision or whatever the vision is, and then you can literally dissect the patient in real time in front of you.
Okay, I'm gonna stab you there. I'm gonna hold you to one over you.
Well, for me, I'm a coder, so at heart. So, you know, what really excites me is the new AI tools for coding. But it also adds an element of concern for me because I'm concerned about the job satisfaction of coders now. You know, we're becoming much more directors and a lot less having to use the sort of logical side of our brains. That's really exciting and fun when coding. So the coding tools like Cursor, et cetera, I think are incredible and very exciting. But I'm also concerned for people's well-being, for developers, et cetera.
Nice. Well, you've already answered our next question, so I'm gonna pivot over. Ben, what's a tech that makes you the most concerned right now? We already had David's answer.
I think, you know, if we think about how technology has grown, it's grown in a way that it's been led by people maybe in the top 5%. All of your listeners are people that are the first to adopt change. And I think the way that we've done that has left the remaining 95% or a large proportion of that behind. And we've not designed things that fit around our world. Like, you know, how many times are you spending looking down at a screen? And that's not normal.
So is it like tech design, like the way it's been designed or not for humans, like ergonomics? Like what's the specific?
Yeah, I think it's greater than that. I think it's to do with how do we want technology to fit around our lives?
Yeah, yeah.
And currently the way we design it is based on a very niche group of people and their beliefs, how they want it and spread it across. And we don't really know the consequences to that.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see a way that we could flip that narrative slightly and design for based on people's lives that are not the ones that are pushing the products on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've heard it said that, you know, we've had this, the initial era of like, you know, we have all these apps for the coders and how they live. And, you know, a lot of them, they lived in their mom's basement and their moms were doing things for them. So they, of course they build apps for food delivery and laundry and all the things that their moms did for that. How do we move out of that era into, you know, creating things like deep medical where this is something a system needs or, you know, broader population needs? I think that's really fascinating of like who's driving the innovation. So good point there. I would love to hear from each of you. Who's a literal human, small L, small H, who's been integral to your career journey that you each want to shout out? Maybe starting with you, David.
Yeah, sure. I guess mine would probably be who I sadly don't know, but Demis Hassabis, obviously the founder and CEO of Google DeepMind. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is, you know, in 2016, I took a very sharp career change. And I used to be in finance, but I did AI back in 2009. But it was actually because of the work that Demis was doing at DeepMind that I really thought two things. One, that AI was getting, had moved on a hell of a lot and was getting interesting again. And secondly, I came to the conclusion that if you're not the one helping to build it, then, you know, you're going to be, it's better to be building the technology of the future than not part of it.
You're receiving it.
So I actually, that's what inspired me to go back to university, to go back to UCL and go into AI.
Nice.
So I really have Demis to thank for that. But sadly, I've never met him in person.
Well, maybe this is your chance. We'll make sure this episode finds its way to Dennis's desk. Maybe we'll have him on the pod at some point. How about you, Ben?
For me, I think when I started the company or just early on, I was matched with a mentor through this thing called the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Program, which is a support group for people who are looking to start companies as clinicians. And I was matched with a guy called Stephen Hess. So Stephen had set up a couple of businesses, sold a couple of businesses, most recently to Omnicom Media Group. And he really like changed a lot of my thinking and helped me actually make the step to leave clinical practice and enter a startup. And luckily, we've been able to convince him to join us as well. And so now he's more full-time into the business as well. So continues to be and is a real integral part of my career journey.
Nice. Something to be said for meeting your heroes, it sounds like. So last question, what's an inspirational quote that maybe has stuck with each of you or both of you as part of your journey in tech?
Yeah, I mean, if I go first, I think, you know, one of the sort of, I'm not sure who said it first, but I'm a great believer that if you give yourself 6 months to do a task, it will take 6 months. And if you give yourself 6 hours, it will take 6 hours. So really, that's something that I try and live by. For example, I've got engaged and trying to do the wedding in 2 months' time and living with the struggles of that. So it's definitely a motto that I try and live by. But I think that's a really good one because I really do think you get to the crux of what you're trying to decide in just a shorter time if you give yourself less time to do it. So
definitely
for me, that's belief.
Best of luck. Congratulations there.
Thanks.
How about you, Ben?
I think, you know, I don't know who actually wrote this quote, but it was that, you know, we will never as startups be able to outcompete based on resources. And the only way that we can really compete is the way and the quality of our thinking. Mm. So we should try and make it as creative and beautiful as possible and bring the right people around you for that journey. So, you know, I think that's something that I really try and think and live by, which is, you know, what are the ways that we can improve the way that we're thinking so that we're solving the right problem and beating the competition by that way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, guys, this has been a fantastic episode. I mean, I mentioned to you in the pre-show, like, I love what you're doing. And I think this conversation highlights you're not just optimizing systems, you're making healthcare more human. And that's something we really appreciate. And just the stats, the incredible stats about, you know, millions of new appointments that were sort of uncovered and, you know, millions of pounds and dollars, you know, being saved and in terms of this healthcare systems being optimized. I mean, that's just incredible. So our mission at LH is to attach a rocket ship to the causes and mission-driven products like yours. And so it's such a privilege. I tell people I have the best job in the world. I get to talk to founders like yourself and help them grow, you know, their incredible mission. So yeah, just thank you on behalf of all of us who use the NHS and the American healthcare system. Really appreciate what you're doing.
Well, thanks so much, Paul. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And thanks for the great question.
Yeah, of course. Well, if you can let our listeners know, where can they find out more about Deep Medical and maybe even contribute to the next funding round that y'all are working on?
Yeah, so you can reach out to us, info@deep-medical.ai. We have a website. You can Google that for Deep Medical. We're also on LinkedIn. So, you know, you're more than welcome to search for us on there and reach out directly as well.
Cool. Well, we'll make sure to put that in the show notes. And for all the folks who are listening, please, thank you so much. Keep listening. Give us a rating, give us a review. It helps us bring great guests onto the pod like Dr. Benjamin Deldar and David Hanbury to talk about their great work at Deep Medical and using AI to solve patient no-shows in the NHS and also in the US healthcare system. So thanks again, guys. And thanks everybody for listening. Take care.